Minor Tyranny and the Civil War. Even though the Tehran parliamentary experiment had collapsed, there was still a flicker of hope in the provinces. In the following months, a prolonged and at times bloody urban war was waged between the revolutionary fighters and a combination of local royalists, mostly of the Anjuman-e-Islamiyye, Islamic Anjuman, belonging to the Ursuli neighbourhoods of Tabriz, who collaborated with the government troops. During the latter half of 1908 and early 1909, even before the fall of the Majles, the Tabriz militia put up an armed struggle that shifted the fortunes of the constitutional revolution, making it even more populist, nationalist, and secular. Once it had grown into a national movement, the civil war consolidated Iran's national community perhaps more than any other single event in the 20th century before the oil nationalization movement of the 1950s. Tabriz was the predictable stage for such a struggle. Like any former capital, there existed a sense of pride and power there, reinforced by the strength of the Tabriz economy, the growth of its population, and its relative openness to the Western presence and practices. As Iran's largest and most prosperous city, with a population of more than 200,000, it was the hub of northern trade connecting the Anatolian and Caucasian overland routes to the Black Sea and to the Russian railway across the Caucasian border, and thus the Russian, Ottoman, and European markets. Importing manufactured goods, fabrics, and consumer commodities, the Tabriz merchants competed with the European commercial agents in the city, despite unequal customs duties and other disadvantages. The export market of Tabriz, including various cash crops and a magnificent handmade carpet industry that by the turn of the century had surpassed those of Kashan and Isfahan, brought significant income to the city. The Tabriz merchant class financed the constitutional movement and the eventual civil revolt, while the poor and disadvantaged local labour, mostly peasants who intended to benefit from the urban economy, provided the manpower. Foreign connections brought modern schools and hospitals, including those established by American Presbyterian missionaries. By the turn of the century, city and provincial telephone lines were established. Road and railroad connections to the Caucasian cities and beyond carried Azerbaijani migrant workers to the Baku oil fields, where they constituted the largest ethnic group, and to other Russian cities in search of work. They came back from Baku and Tiflis, then hotbeds of revolutionary socialism, with new radical ideas. Azerbaijani merchant capitalists, who made their fortunes in Baku, Tiflis, and Istanbul, also viewed with pride and sympathy the growth of the constitutional movement in their homeland. The city's large and industrious Armenian community also served as an important conduit for technology and business, as well as for revolutionary ideas. Yet, despite tokens of modernity, Tabriz was a traditional city with strong loyalties to religion and geography. Still tied to Shi'i rituals and shrines, the political maneuvering of influential mujtahids and old sectarian conflicts divided the city. While some of the largest of the 12 city wards, mahalleh, were identified as Sheikhi, for following mujtahids from that school, since the early decades of the 19th century, possibly replacing the older sectarian loyalties, other important wards were identified as matashareh, Sharia-orientated, for their loyalty to the Ursuli mujtahids. As in most other Iranian cities, urban wards served not only as units of municipal administration and a source of communal loyalty, but also as bases of operation for the neighbourhood vigilantes, generally identified as lutis, with their often precarious life of extortion, violence, and acting as hired daggers for the city notables. As much as there were bad lutis, known for their dangerous conduct, there were also good lutis, credited with protecting the neighbourhood and extending charity to the poor. With their own code of honour, demeanour, lingo, hierarchy, and appearance, the lutis were feared but also admired. The two most prominent popular leaders of the Tabriz resistance, Sattar Khan and Borger Khan, who later were elevated to the status of national heroes, were luti leaders, as were many of their fellow fighters. They were associated with the Sheikhi wards of Amirhiz and Khayaban, respectively, both of which played a pivotal role in the success of the Tabriz resistance. It was primarily the two leaders' sectarian rivalry with Lutis of the opposite league that shaped the conflict and ensured its resilience. But, contrary to earlier instances of urban strife, the two leaders were operating largely as free agents. This gave the resistance a popular character, somewhat distinct from the politics of the elites that had so far characterized the constitutional revolution. Over the course of the fighting in 1908 and 1909, neighborhood loyalties transcended their immediate surroundings to include Tabriz and eventually the whole of the country. The accelerating revolutionary process clearly set supporters of the constitution, Mashruteh Khwahan, against the royalist camp, who invariably labelled them supporters of the tyranny, Mustabedin. That the Sheikhi quarters opposed the royalist cause was not accidental, nor was the backing of the Asuli quarters for Muhammad Ali Shah and for Nuriz Mashru'eh. The Sheikhis had a natural propensity for new ideas and institutions, which can be attributed at least in part to their theology of reconciling the Sharia with ideas of historical progression, but also to their place in society as upholders of an alternative creed. In contrast, the anti-constitutional Islamic Anjuman of Tabriz, operating out of the Dovechi ward, was subsidized by the Shah's court to prop up local support for the government onslaught. Activism in Tabriz, though, was based on more than neighborhood politics. The so-called Markaz-e-Ghebi, the invisible center, an early clandestine revolutionary cell founded by a certain Ali Monsieur, perhaps on the model of the secret societies of the French Revolution, motivated by socialist ideas in vogue in the Caucasus during and after the 1905 Russian Revolution. It was instrumental in organizing the Tabriz neighborhood militias into an effective fighting force. A large number of émigré revolutionaries from among the Muslims, Armenians and Georgians of Baku and Tiflis also joined the resistance. The Baku Social Democratic Party, which included Iranian émigrés and Russian Social Democrats, also supported Tabriz with manpower, money, weapons and tactical advice. Sattar Khan, 1866-1914, a former horse trader and reformed Luti, was a natural leader whose gift for urban warfare complemented his habit of extorting contributions for the national cause. Access to the government arsenal inside the Tabriz citadel allowed the fighters, who had adopted the general name Fada'i, devotee, to indulge in a cache of weapons, ammunition, and field guns. Using local expertise, and often improvising, they fortified barricades, gates, and other strategic locations around constitutionalist wards. Beginning with a handful of devotees, Sattar endured not only enemy fire, but also defection from his own ranks. Motivated by neighborhood rivalry, personal gain, and a code of honor, he did not easily accept defeat. Though at the outset the Fada'is were primarily motivated by neighborhood loyalties, over time they cultivated greater appreciation for the value of constitutionalism. For the Tehran coup to succeed, subduing the Tabriz rebels seemed essential, and the Shah mustered all the forces he had to achieve this objective. At the outset, and at an enormous cost, he mobilized several regiments from Azerbaijan and elsewhere, and sent off to Tabriz the Shah Seven irregular cavalry. Later, Cossack reinforcements were dispatched. He financed and gave his blessings to the Tabriz Islamic Anjuman and its affiliated Usuli Ulama in the royalist wards. Under the pretext of protecting foreign nationals, the Russian consulate in the city also collaborated with the Shah. The government forces almost succeeded in their objective to isolate Sattar, Borger, and a handful of their cohorts. But as time passed, fortunes changed once the Fada'is learned how to conduct urban warfare. Government troops in and around the city relentlessly pounded their positions and engaged in pitched battles in narrow streets and in orchards and adjacent villages. Casualties were heavy on both sides throughout the 11 months, amounting to at least 5,000 dead and many more injured and displaced. Parts of Tabriz were ruined, and villages at the outskirts and along the trade routes in every direction suffered. Innocent citizens were plundered and killed, and merchandise in the Tabriz bazaar and in a new shopping arcade was looted or destroyed by the troops, armed brigands, and by the constitutionalist partisans. At first, looting and extortion were about the only means of survival for the starving Qajar army and the revolutionary fighters. Later, however, the revolutionary leadership enforced greater discipline among their troops and gradually improvised a chain of command, including fighting units with regular shifts, detachments for special tasks, logistics, a camp kitchen, medical aids, including a camp hospital, makeshift communication and intelligence, a minimum wage, and even a uniform Fadai Karakul cap. These improvements allowed the Tabriz fighters to defend their ground, but they barely made any physical advances between July and October 1908. What was at stake, however, was a symbolic resistance against the Tehran regime that neither the Shah nor his Russian backers could afford to ignore. When a new round of fighting began in March 1909, after a three-month lull, the Tabriz fighters enjoyed better finances, thanks to a donation committee that had been established to persuade affluent citizens to contribute. They acquired superior weapons, and above all, there was growing moral support within Iran and beyond in the Caucasus and the Ottoman Empire. The Young Turk Revolution that had removed Sultan Abdulhamid from power in April 1908 was welcomed by the fighters in Tabriz as much as it was despised by Muhammad Ali Shah in Tehran. High morale is evident in numerous group photographs that have survived. Tabriz fighters proudly pose for the camera with their rifles, rounds of ammunition and cannon. The palpable allure of firearms in the photographs of the time signified a new mood of defiance, as if weapons empowered ordinary citizens to resist the coercive state and its agents. The photographs, and especially portrayals of the two leaders of the resistance, widely circulated in the form of postcards. They were meant to build up confidence among the people of Azerbaijan and the rest of the country, and soon after to celebrate their victory. And in that, images of the photogenic satar proved particularly effective. The sense of camaraderie was also evident in the way that Georgian and Armenian, as well as Baku Muslim volunteers, were incorporated into the Tabriz resistance. Recruited by the Baku Social Democratic Party and other radical organizations, these militia forces brought with them superior techniques of urban warfare and a new revolutionary spirit, which helped transform the Tabriz resistance into a national struggle. The Georgian detachment of 100 volunteers was skilled in urban warfare and the use of explosives, whereas the Armenian Dashnaktsu Tune nationalists were experienced in tactical warfare. Baku socialists, in contrast, were critical in supplying ammunition and new weaponry, and in transferring funds and crossing government lines at great risk and loss of life. Of the handful of Westerners who observed the Tabriz resistance, one decided to join in. Howard Baskerville, a 24-year-old Nebraskan and recent graduate of Princeton, who was serving as a teacher of English and science at the American Presbyterian Memorial Boys' School in Tabriz, was a passionate volunteer. Moved by the courage and sacrifice of the Tabriz fighters, and especially the assassination of one of his Iranian colleagues, and despite the wishes of the American consulate, he resigned from his post and embarked on training an elite force. At one time, the group totaled nearly 150 volunteers from among the city's affluent youth. Relying on his own rudimentary military training, Baskerville and his rescue squad hoped to break the government siege of the Fadahi neighborhoods by a surprise attack on the Cossack contingent that was camping at the edge of the city. Despite Satar's reluctance and lacking the support of his own volunteers, Baskerville decided to charge, only to be shot point blank. His grand funeral was a tribute more to his heroism than his good judgment. It was also the height of an ecumenical camaraderie that broke through ethnicity, religion, and nationality. Baskerville's death occurred at the height of the Tabriz resistance in April 1909. Mustering all its forces, the Tehran government eventually, and with great difficulty, blockaded all supply routes to Tabriz in hopes of starving the city into surrender. The grievous siege of Tabriz between January and April, which caused widespread shortages, had the potential to break the resisting constitutionalists. Although fighting forces in Rasht and Isfahan, by then called the Nationalists, Meliyun, were acting in greater accord with Tabriz, and although the Tehran regime appeared pliant, issuing a royal decree that promised restoration of the constitutional regime, the Russian legation in Tehran, conveying St. Petersburg's wishes, was not willing to compromise. The loss of Tabriz would be a serious blow to Russian prestige, not only because the Tsarist government was heavily invested in Muhammad Ali Shah's survival, but also because a constitutionalist victory could rekindle a revolutionary spirit in the Caucasus. All the more, even the liberal press in St. Petersburg praised the Tabriz fighters and was critical of Tehran's callous despotism. Securing the safety of Russian nationals offered the needed pretext for Russian troops to intervene in accordance with the Anglo-Russian Agreement of 1907 and with the tacit approval of London. They crossed the Iranian border and by the end of April 1909 marched into Tabriz. Their arrival, the first since the 1827 occupation of the city after Iran's defeat in the war with Russia, aroused mixed feelings among the inhabitants. It opened the supply lines, relieving starvation, and facilitated the resumption of trade. The de facto ceasefire brought calm and security, which had been missing since the start of the fighting nearly a year before. Yet occupation was seen as a major setback for the national struggle. Though government troops lifted the siege, retreated to their camps, or withdrew completely from around the city, the prospects of the Russian military presence were ominous enough for Muhammad Ali Shah. Seldom in Iran's history had an urban uprising succeeded in repelling government troops. But even less typical was the support of a tribal power for a popular urban cause. The Bakhtiaris of central and southwestern Iran, arguably the largest confederacy in the country, were an odd candidate to support Tabriz, since a few detachments of Bakhtiari horsemen were among the government troops fighting in Tabriz. Yet a rival faction in the Bakhtiari leadership turned in favour of the constitutionalists. It was headed by Ali Gholi Khan Sadr Assad, 1856-1917, a cultivated Khan with nationalist predilections, whose interest in Iranian history and that of his own tribe, along with his previous residence in Europe, had converted him into a liberal nationalist of some valour. Beginning early in 1909, the Bakhtiari horsemen under his command, well equipped by standards of the time, were a formidable force in the south of the country. Unlike the constitutionalist fighters in the Tabriz wards, they enjoyed the freedom of the steppes and nomadic mobility, which allowed them to capture Isfahan with relative ease. Sadr Assad was successful in forging a semblance of unity among the Khans of his tribe's major league. That the Bakhtiari lands happened to be where oil was first discovered in Iran as early as 1908 was not entirely irrelevant to the future prominence of this tribe in national politics. In 1909, however, the issue of oil and British dealings with the Bakhtiaris were not yet a factor. The call for a concerted march to Tehran first came from the fighters in Rasht, where an assortment of Caucasian Social Democrats and Armenian volunteers, arriving in Russian vessels via the Caspian, joined hands with the Rasht fighters for control of the provincial centre. They came to be known as Meliyun, nationalists. As with the Bakhtiaris, here too a major local dignitary, Gholam Hossein Khan Tonikaboni, later known as Sepahdar, and some of his allies among the landowning classes of prosperous Gilan province, shifted their loyalties from Tehran to the nationalists' side. Sepahdar, who earlier had fought with his troops against the Tabriz resistance, reappeared in a new nationalist guise. His rise to prominence denoted the dawn of a provincial landowning class that would come to play a major role in the politics of the post-revolutionary era. Despite the despair and uncertainty of the moment, there was an air of optimism for constitutional restoration, and even though radical elements vowed to remove Muhammad Ali Shah, there was a fair amount of support for compromise as well. This virtual telegraphic community in Iran, for they primarily communicated through telegraphic messages, was defiant toward elements within the Tehran court, and in that they found themselves in a surprising accord with the two neighboring powers. In April 1909, a strongly worded Anglo-Russian memorandum warned the Shah that unless he restored the constitution and removed its enemies from his court, he stood to lose the two powers already sinking confidence in him, a warning that appeared to the Shah's opposition as a green light to capture Tehran. In reality, It was meant to encourage the Shah to restore some semblance of a constitutional regime in order to stop the constitutionalists' advances. Restoration of the Constitution. On July 13, 1909, the Nationalist Forces, as they collectively came to be known, headed jointly by Sadr Assad and Sepah Dar, finally entered the capital. The skirmishes south of Tehran with the demoralized Cossack regiments headed by Russian officers and regular government troops were indecisive. Despite months of repeated Russian and British warnings that jointly and individually demanded that the nationalists stay away from the capital, a force of nearly 3,000 Bakhtiari and Gilan fighters engaged for 2 days in a mopping-up operation inside the capital. Colonel Lyakhov and his troops surrendered, only to be commissioned, ironically, back into service by the nationalists, even though they momentarily faded out of the revolutionary limelight. Muhammad Ali Shah himself and an entourage of 500, including his hated army chief, Hossein Pasha Amir Bahadur Jang, negotiated his way to the Russian legation, where he took refuge under the joint protection of the two powers. Conscious of European sensitivities, the nationalists quickly secured diplomatic missions and assured the safety of foreign residents, even before marching to the ruins of the Majlis building, where, on July the 15th, they officially announced the abdication of Muhammad Ali Shah from the Qajar throne. With a discipline that impressed even the mostly hostile European press corps, the Bakhtiari tribesmen and a contingent of the Armenian fighters from Gilan restored order in the capital, set up a rudimentary headquarters, and soon declared Muhammad Ali Shah's minor son, Sultan Ahmad, 1898-1930, as the new Shah. The elder of the Qajar tribe, Ali Reza Azad-al-Mulk, 1847-1910, became his regent. By any account, the success of the nationalist forces was impressive. There was no looting, revenge killing, or retaliation. Even more remarkable was the level of cooperation between the heterogeneous rank and file of Gilani and Bakhtiari fighters, who could barely communicate with one another in Persian. The conquest of Tehran was an ephemeral but defining moment in Iran's modern history. Soon after the arrival of the Tabriz fighters and their heroes, Sattar Khan, now celebrated as Sadar Emeli, national commander, and his colleague Borger Khan, as Salar Meli, national chief, instilled a spirit of optimism in the hearts of many Iranians. Deposing Muhammad Ali Shah and his Mashrueh ally, despite Russia's unabashed backing of the royalists, was a rare triumph in the age of high imperialism. For a moment, it seemed as if the desire to create a liberal democratic order had overcome not only the impediments of arbitrary rule and reactionary ulama, but also brutish European imperial ambitions. It was as though, through a national struggle and its narrative of salvation, the beast of misrule and misery had been subdued and a new road to prosperity paved. The new Ahmad Shah was hailed as a constitutional monarch, despite some talk of republicanism in the radical circles. The nationalists' manoeuvring to power and the level of independence their leaders displayed took the representatives of Russia and Britain by surprise and generated much dismay. Russia had only complied with restoration of the constitution and abdication of the former Shah with grudges, and Britain was not far behind. By the time Tehran was taken by the nationalists, at least 3,000 Russian troops had already crossed the border and occupied northern Iran, stretching from Azerbaijan to Gilan and northern Khorasan and advancing as far south as Qazvin, only 95 miles from the capital. The audacity with which Imperial Russia trampled Iran's sovereignty, contrary to the terms of the Anglo-Russian agreement ensuring the opposite, apparently required not even a diplomatic fig leaf. No longer shackled by a British counteraction, the Russian move had already cast its shadow over the newly restored but fragile regime. It also heightened anti-Russian sentiments that had been boiling up since the turn of the 20th century. Iranians admired Japan's victory in the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 and saw it as a promising sign that a European expansionist empire could be defied, if not defeated. Earlier defeats of the British colonial army in the Second Anglo-Boer War in 1902 stirred similar sentiments, even worse than Russian intervention, now masked as preserving its interests, were the Russians' profound cultural biases. The condescension of diplomatic communiques about the nationalists' advances and their eventual victory was outdone only by the hostile reporting of newspapers such as the Times of London and echoed by the New York Times, among others. That the Iranians could resist, fight back, and defeat a regime militarily backed and financially buttressed by European imperial powers was something that could not be easily accepted or forgiven. Evoking familiar Orientalist paradigms, there was an obsessive anxiety that the safety of the European residents in Tehran would be violated by hordes of nomadic invaders and socialist radicals. Their expressed disbelief that the capital could be captured without bloodshed was even more telling, while at the same time conveniently ignored the arrival of the Russian invaders in the north. Reading between the lines, one can see in the begrudging expression of approval for the nationalists' success a sceptical dismissal that the constitutional project could never succeed, as if a scheme to destroy this delicate chance was already lurking in the back of diplomats' minds. The coverage of the Tabriz resistance, the recapture of Tehran, and the downfall of Muhammad Ali Shah inaugurated Iran's first major exposure in the international press, making front-page headlines. A handful of correspondents from English, Russian, and French dailies and freelance observers with diverse viewpoints brought to Western audiences the unfolding of a struggle that contradicted stereotypes of indolence and deceit meticulously crafted over centuries and even admitted by Iranians in their own narratives of decline. Now there was a new revolutionary resolve apparent even in the midst of the civil war. Awaiting the final assault on Tehran in his camp outside the capital, Sadr Assad, the French-educated Bakhtiari Khan, daringly replied to the English and Russian representatives who were warning him of the dire consequences of storming the capital in one sentence, "On se verra à Tehran." See you in Tehran. Contrary to the cynicism of most European observers, and contrary to perceptions of failure in later historiography, the Emergency Committee, formed just after the conquest of the capital, mustered an impressive list of accomplishments. To restore calm and security to the terrorized capital, the committee put Yeprem Khan, 1868-1912, an Armenian revolutionary commander originally from the Ganje province, today in the Republic of Azerbaijan, in charge of Tehran's police department. With his aides among the rashed fighters, he quickly ended the looting and terrorizing by government troops, by irregulars disbanded after the collapse of the old regime, and by the newly arrived revolutionary forces. The committee, or Supreme Council, as it came to be known, consisted of the two nationalist leaders and a number of ministers from among the younger bureaucratic elite. Soon to be dominated by Taghizadeh, who had returned from his exile, the committee came to play a major part in the days after the restoration of the constitution. It allocated ministries to its members, but avoided appointing a prime minister, and it successfully negotiated the terms for the exile of the deposed Shah. Through the mediation of the two powers, the committee granted the deposed Shah a hefty salary and saw that he would be deported along with his entourage. Once a revolutionary cabinet was formed with Sepahdar as premier, the electoral law was swiftly revised, replacing the seven classes of deputies of the first Majlis with direct representation. A nationwide election was held, and by November 1909, the second Majlis was in session. More symbolic and more daring were the trials held shortly after the nationalists' victory. To the Supreme Council's credit, a national amnesty was declared, and there were hardly any vengeful killings. Only a handful of reactionaries were arrested and tried. Of the five who were executed by order of a special tribunal on specific charges of murdering constitutionalist protesters in the sanctuary of Abd al-Azim during the final days of the old regime, the most prominent was Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri, the relentless opponent of the constitutionalists. The tribunal held as proof of its verdict Nuri's fatwa to the effect that killing the protesters in the sanctuary was lawful. It hence underscored the new regime's wishes not to punish anyone for ideological orientation. In the final months of the so-called minor tyranny, as the period of the civil war came to be known, Nuri had abandoned his earlier call for Mashru'e in favour of the old absolutist order and avowed support for Muhammad Ali Shah's suppression of the constitutionalists. With peculiar zeal, he orchestrated clerical petitions from the growing number of clergy in Tehran and elsewhere, expressing loyalty to the Qajar regime and warning the Shah of any compromise that might result in restoration of the constitution. Hanged by the gallows in Tabkhane Square, in front of a dazed public witnessing the unprecedented execution of a Mojtahid, one of the most prominent Shi'i jurists of his time, the execution was emblematic of changing times. It seemed as though the kingship and the clergy, the two pillars of the ancient Iranian order, were cracked, if not shattered, by contingencies of a modern revolutionary movement. Another encouraging sign of change was the diversity of voices in the public sphere. The growth of the press and publications, the emergence of parliamentary factions and political parties, the first audible pleas of women protesting society's misogynistic norms, and a greater sophistication in cultural and political discourse were evident and seemingly irreversible. By the end of 1909, there were half a dozen dailies and a growing number of book titles catering to a larger readership. In the following months and years, despite major upheavals, the number of newspapers multiplied, and although many of them were short-lived, they demonstrated not only a new relish in the freedom of expression, even freedom to slander, but also the potency of the press in fashioning the country's nascent public opinion. Among the most articulate was the daily Iran-e-No, New Iran, edited by the formidable Azerbaijani socialist Mohammad Amin Razalzadeh, 1884-1955, who later was a founding father of the Azerbaijan Socialist Republic. Iran-e-No offered domestic and international coverage, acute political analysis, and debates on poverty, corruption, elitist polity, conservative Islam, and women's rights. Yet there was a limit to how far the burgeoning press could challenge the time-honoured sanctions. Already in late 1909, largely to counterbalance the effects of Nuri's execution and to exonerate itself as the guardian of Islam, the revolutionary regime convicted a leading journalist of the time, Hassan Ma'ayed al-Islam Kashani, editor of the celebrated Habl al-Mateen, of blasphemy. He was sentenced to 3 years imprisonment for alleging in a rhetorical piece that the religion of the 7th century Arabs and subsequent primacy of Islamic conservatism were at the root of Iran's backwardness and steady decline. Whatever its historical accuracy, such claims, ironically made by a man whose title meant confirmer of Islam, heralded the agnostic, even anti-Islamic, propensity among modernists of the period. Idealizing the ancient Iranian past as an alternative to its recent Islamic legacy was to become a pillar of Iranian conscious nationalism in the post-constitutional period. More immediately, however, the episode foreshadowed the clashes in the political arena between conservatives and progressives. Obstacles to the democratic process. The very convening of the Second Majlis, though a victory for the nationalists, was riddled with factionalism, ideological rifts, and foreign intimidation. These pressures brought the Majlis to a temporary halt by December 1911 and resulted in suspension of the constitution. The period between 1909 and 1911, and in a broader sense between 1905 and 1921, proved an unequal experiment in Iranian history. Remarkable though it was, however, it ended in tragic setbacks, for it was unable not only to keep European intrusion at bay, but also bar the old landed elite from return to power. Two broad political tendencies emerged in the Second Majlis, each with its own support from among activists and the press, even though the revolutionary Anjumans of the First Majlis failed to transform fully into political parties and even to effective interest groups. The moderates, Etedaliyun, as they came to be known, were the largest bloc, consisting of landowning magnates and tribal leaders among the nationalists, the younger generation of the Qajar officialdom, remnants of the Qajar elite who adjusted to the new realities, and the leaders of the Tabriz resistance, including Sattar Khan and Borger Khan. The social democrats, Ejtema'iyun, Amiyun, or simply Democrats, as the Progressives came to be known, were mostly intellectuals inspired by European liberal thought, by the Caucasian and Russian socialists, and by the Young Turks who had recently come to power in the Ottoman Empire. In contrast to the moderates' gradualist approach, the Social Democrats intended to carry out a comprehensive program of reforms, the rudiments of which were already laid out in the debates of the first Majlis and articulated in exile during the Minor Tyranny. Best known among the Democrats was Taghizadeh, who allied with progressive elements ranging from members of the nobility with a socialist bent, Sadr Assad, and liberal ulama of the younger generation, to some revolutionary fighters and influential journalists. The Democrats' most urgent demands included basic land reform, the elimination of hereditary privileges, public education, use of the state apparatus for social reform, and even a call for the inclusion of women in the public arena. They shared with their moderate colleagues, with varying degrees of sincerity, calls for the unification of Iran's armed forces and an urgent need to restore security and peace in the provinces, centralize finances, and increase state revenue through efficient taxation and the establishment of a national bank. Put simply, the party had to address the dire needs of a nearly bankrupt government that had grown in size over the previous decade. A comprehensive program such as this was bound to encounter obstacles, especially in the area of security and finances. Most glaring, yet predictable, was a sharpening divide among the constitutionalists, which soon led to political assassinations and factional clashes. The most notable victim of political unrest was Sayed Abdullah Behbahani, a clerical icon of the constitutional struggle. In June 1910, he was assassinated by a Caucasian terrorist cell associated with Haydar Khan Amu Agla, who apparently had taken his cue from Taghizadeh and his radical supporters. Behbahani's fall displayed a resistance among the Democrats toward the presence of the clerical dignitaries on the political stage. This surely contributed to demoralizing the ulama and even the diminishing pro-constitutional wing of the Shi'i leadership in Iran and in Iraq. Mullah Muhammad Kazem Khorasani, 1839-1911, a leading pro-constitutional jurist and a marja'a in Najaf and his anti-constitutional rival, found themselves united in denouncing Taghizadeh as a heretic and calling for the exile and punishment of his cohorts. The other clerical father of the constitutional revolution, Sayed Muhammad Tabatabai, had wisely retired from politics. He later died in Tehran in near obscurity. The clerical element did not abandon the revolutionary state altogether, but never again would it occupy the prominent position it had maintained since the tobacco protest of 1891. The incident also demonstrated the disruptive role of the radical left in the politics of the period. Three major assassination attempts since 1907, all orchestrated by Haydar Khan and his cohorts, helped polarize the climate. In the decade after 1911, more political violence justified further draconian measures. A more extensive clash between rival revolutionary factions occurred shortly afterward in August 1910. Most Tabriz fighters, headed by Sattar Khan, backed the moderates. Yet they acted as free agents, causing huge problems of law and order in the capital. Their street clashes with the equally rowdy and superior in number Bakhtiari fighters from the province of Isfahan were seen by the Supreme Council as a precursor to another civil war. The Tabriz Fadai's grievances revolved around their inability to financially support themselves, which in turn made some resort to extorting the rich. Their exclusion from the newly reorganized police force under Yeprem Khan was another source of discontent. Accused of insubordination, the Azerbaijani fighters who were clustered in the Atabak Park, the confiscated residence of the assassinated Premier Amin el-Sultan, engaged in a random shootout with government troops. The combined forces of Cossack regiments serving under the revolutionary government, the regular troops, and the Bakhtiari riflemen routed the Fadai's resistance. Sattar Khan, who unsuccessfully tried to mediate a ceasefire, was shot in the ankle and removed from Atabak Park in disgrace. The Tabriz fighters were disarmed, and some of the most radical elements among them, mostly Caucasians, were forced to return to their homelands. The incident was a clear victory for the government and the Majles, which had long called for the disarming of the revolutionary factions. Sattar's own downfall epitomized the end to street resistance in favor of the provincial landed elite that came to substitute for the old Qajar nobility and the new generation of the officials, mostly sons of high bureaucrats of the Nasseri period, who had been brought up in wealth and privilege. The latter formed the backbone of a new class of officialdom. Mostly educated in Europe or exposed to Western ways, the air of respectability of these ministers and officials came to define the emerging polity of the period and the conduct of its agents. The large landowners, who were their natural allies, were distant from the mass constituency of the revolution who had put them in office. Yet patriotism, devotion to the constitution, and belief in reform and progress were still powerful motives among the members of the new elite, often outweighing personal and group interests. What was missing was a common vision to nurture an indigenous mode of democracy that had been first made tangible in its early days of the revolution. The new elite simulated this goal more in form than in substance. What remained a characteristic of the post-revolutionary period, for instance, was the mutual distrust between the Majles and the executive branch, manned by the political elite. Between March 1907 and November 1911, there were 11 changes of prime ministers and additional reshuffling of the cabinets. The widespread problem of a rapid succession of weak and irresolute governments, each holding power for a few months, recalled musical chairs, with characters from the old and new elite routinely occupying various posts to a monotonous tune of timidity and indecision. The ministers were often backed by the moderates in the Majles, who viewed the ministers' inefficiency as an opportunity to protect their own privileges against threats from the Democrats' quarter. Both tendencies, however, shared the misperception that the Majles function did not end with legislation, but also included close monitoring of the day-to-day affairs of the executive branch, a notion understood by many in the parliament as an abiding principle of constitutionalism. Even if such confusion in the division of powers can be excused in a nascent democratic experiment, the obvious increase in foreign influences cannot. In the following years, leading up to the rise of Reza Khan Pahlavi in 1921, Russia and Britain brazenly pressured the government and the Majles, persuading its members through intimidation or favours. The Russians in particular acted with a vengeance, having felt discredited after the fall of Muhammad Ali Shah. Even more than the Qajar officials of the past decades, some members of the new elite feared the European powers and their intrigues, or felt helplessly inferior, if not entirely submissive, to them. The haughty conduct of the two powers, especially during the 1911 Shuster episode, fostered feelings of desperation and disillusionment among Iranian statesmen and the public. The Shuster episode. Following an initiative in the Majles to reform the country's finances and the urgency for an efficient revenue collection, the Iranian legation in Washington, D.C., asked the U.S. State Department to recommend an American financial advisor to serve as Treasurer General of Iran. William Morgan Shuster, a banker who had also served in the U.S. government with integrity and candor, was recommended at a time when Iranian finances were suffering from diminishing income, the obligation to service foreign loans, and growing expenses. The Iranian public finance, fiscal policy, and tax collection, though partially improved by greater centralization, still suffered from the arcane practices of the state accountants. Employing an American expert was thought to be prudent because it would have saved Iran from pressures exerted by the neighboring powers. Shuster's arrival stirred excitement among nationalists while causing anxiety to representatives of both powers and their Iranian associates. A man of frank demeanor and daring initiatives, Shuster and his American team represented the first serious involvement of the United States in Iran, albeit as a purely private initiative. Before then, the U.S. presence in Iran had been limited to a few non-governmental areas, including American Presbyterian missionaries who had been active in northwestern Iran among the Nestorian Christians since the 1830s. Later, in the 19th and early 20th centuries, modern American missionary schools in Aramiyeh, Tabriz, Hamadan, and Tehran educated non-Muslims and eventually Muslim girls and boys. Though negotiations to establish diplomatic relations went back to an unratified Treaty of Commerce and Navigation from 1856, it was only in 1883 that formal relations between the United States and Iran materialized. Even then, despite Iran's repeated attempts under Nasser ad-Din Shah to engage the United States in trade, finance, and security, even offering the right to a naval presence in the Persian Gulf to counter British predominance, there was a serious reluctance on the side of the Americans to cross into the traditionally recognized Anglo-Russian zones of influence. Recommending Schuster, even though he was first cleared with the British embassy, indicated a cautious change in American attitudes toward the emerging democratic regime in Iran. From the start, Schuster rebuked Iran's chaotic finances, political vacillation, and infirmity of the government and the majlis. He was outspoken in his critiques of the imperial powers and their discriminatory practices. In his 1912 The Strangling of Persia, published just after his forced departure from Iran, he gave a vivid portrayal of the Iranian plight in the face of European aggression. He dedicated his book to the Persian people, who, by their unwavering belief under difficult and forbidding circumstances, employed him to help with the task of the reorganization of their nation. In the foreword to the book, he expressed deep disappointment at being forcibly deprived of the opportunity to finish this intensely interesting task in that ancient land, where two powerful and presumably enlightened Christian countries played fast and loose with truth, honor, decency, and law, one at least, hesitating not even at the most barbarous cruelties to accomplish its political designs and to put Persia beyond hope of self-reorganization. In a passionate plea to his American readers, he then stated, "The constitutionalists of modern Persia will not have lived, struggled, and in many instances died entirely in vain if the destruction of Persian sovereignty shall have sharpened somewhat the civilized world's realization of the spirit of international brigandage which marked the Weltpolitik of the year 1911. The lightly veiled reference to Britain and Russia, and especially the latter's hostility toward Iran's constitutional regime, reflects not only Schuster's anti-imperialist sentiments, but also the nature of troubles that he and his American colleagues faced the moment they set foot on Persian soil. Even before he began the financial reorganization, most of his time and energy during his stay, from May 1911 to January 1912, was wasted resisting greedy high officials and the intrigue of the two powers. Preying on the bankrupt treasury, the old elite hoped to secure even more loans, this time £4 million, $20 million, from a private English financier. Moreover, Schuster's effort to organize a new gendarmerie force under the treasury led to an acute crisis that threatened the very survival of the constitutional regime. Shortly after Schuster's arrival, a counter-revolutionary movement reached its peak in July 1911, when the deposed Muhammad Ali Shah, who had resided in Odessa in the Ukraine since his abdication, arrived in the small Caspian port of Gomish-Tepe in northeastern Iran near Astarabad, aboard a Russian steamship. Aided by a few thousand Turkmen tribesmen, he marched toward Tehran. At the same time, his brother, Abul Fat Mirza Salara Dole, 1881-1961, mobilizing the Kurdish tribes of the northwest, occupied the western city of Kermanshah and advanced toward Tabriz and Hamadan. The initiative to restore Muhammad Ali or his brother to the Qajar throne enjoyed more than an implicit blessing from St. Petersburg. Predictably, the news of these advances plunged Tehran into panic. The revolutionary government feared the vim of a Russian reprisal more than the vigor of Turkmen and Kurdish horsemen. Moreover, it could not secure from the representatives of the two powers even verbal condemnation of the pincer assault on the constitutional government, despite their commitments to bar the deposed Shah from ever returning to Iran. The government in Tehran, surrounded by remnants of old Qajar loyalists in the capital, in desperation mobilized an assortment of Bakhtiari horsemen fresh from Isfahan, police detachments under Yeprem Khan, and Armenian volunteers from the Caucasus to march against the counter-revolutionary hordes, who were less than 30 miles from the capital. Persuaded by Shuster, Tehran also issued a public warrant for Muhammad Ali Shah, dead or alive, setting a prize of 100,000 tumans, $237,000. In a brief engagement, the commander of Muhammad Ali Shah's forces was captured and shot. Even before his retreating horsemen arrived back to their base north of Astarabad on the Russian side of the frontier, the deposed Shah boarded the same steamship and fled back to Russia, then Europe. He died in 1925 in exile in San Remo, Italy. Soon after his retreat, Salara Doleh was defeated south of Tehran and fled abroad. The deployment of a Maxim gun operated by a German artillery instructor who was serving with Yeprem's troops inflicted swift military defeat on Salara Doleh's forces. A major blow to the constitutionalists, however, was the loss of Yeprem Khan, who in May 1912 was killed in the course of engagement. By October 1912, all aspirations for restoring the Ancien Régime had dissipated.